Hi, everyone. You're listening to A Second Helping of Hannibal, a spoiler-filled podcast. And in our last three episodes, we recapped and rewatched the season three finale, The Wrath of the Lamb. And now we're going to pick it up right where we left off. So if you haven't heard the last three episodes yet, go ahead and give them a listen. We'll still be here when you're done. Okay, here we go.
Talking about the multiverse, this decision that they make to go over the cliff together, how they can be together without destroying each other, brings us to the conversation about why didn't they kiss? Mm-hmm. Do you feel like now is the time to try to tackle that?
We can definitely discuss it. There is one thing I want to come back and talk about, but we can definitely discuss it. So in leading into this conversation about should they have kissed, it made me think about the Montaigne quote that we've talked about so often. Yes. And that being an idea of this incredibly deep love that people viewed as not being sexual, but greater than a sexual love. And I don't know if we ever read the whole quote, but I want to read it. So
okay.
Here goes. In the friendship I speak of, they mix and work themselves into one piece with so universal a mixture that there is no more sign of the seam by which they were first conjoined. If a man should importune me to give a reason why I loved him, I find it could no otherwise be expressed than by making answer, because it was he, because it was I. There is, beyond all that I am able to say, I know not what inexplicable and fated power that brought on this union. We sought one another long before we met. I think 'twas by some secret appointment of heaven. At our first meeting, we found ourselves so mutually taken with one another, so acquainted, and so endeared betwixt ourselves, that from thenceforward nothing was so near to us as one another. And he's referring to the object of his love. He wrote wherein he excuses the precipitation of our intelligence, so suddenly come to perfection, saying that destined to have so short a continuance as begun so late, for we were both full-grown men, and he some years the older. There was no time to lose, nor were we tied to conform to the examples of those slow and regular friendships that require so many precautions of long preliminary conversation. This has no other idea than that of itself, and can only refer to itself. This is no one special consideration, nor two, nor three, nor four, nor a thousand. 'Tis I know not what quintessence of all this mixture, which, seizing my whole will, carried it to plunge and lose itself in his, and that having seized his whole will, brought it back with equal concurrence and appetite to plunge and lose itself in mine. I may truly say lose, reserving nothing to ourselves that was either his or mine. So I think that's a pretty intense expression of a love that sees itself as a joining of two beings in complete connection. And it's viewed as a platonic, a non-sexual relationship. I don't think you can call this non-romantic, but it's, I believe, to have been non-sexual. So, bringing me to the question of should they have kissed, or did I want them to have kissed? I think when I first saw this scene, there was a part of me that wanted to see the kiss, to basically fulfill a personal fantasy. Like, mm-hmm. Personally, that was something I just wanted. But even at the time wanting that, I didn't feel like anything had been omitted from the finale, right? I wanted it, and yet I didn't feel its absence. Because I think what you want to feel from this relationship is love and romantic love. And in fact, in terms of sex, they've engaged in it. They've engaged in their version of it or a version of it for them. They've shared a physical act that's erotic, that's exhilarating, that involves bodies and bodily fluids, and they reach a climax. And that's sex. And whether if they survive the fall, the relationship would involve sex as we know it, I mean, who knows? Like, that's what fic is for. I kind of personally think yes, because Hannibal is a sensualist and he loves experience, and it would be a unique experience for him to have sex with this intense emotional content, right? Rather than just for manipulation or for physical release. But it reminded me actually of a fic I read a long time ago in another fandom. It involved vampires. It involved a human and a vampire who were embarking on a relationship, and the human believes they're going to have sex. They're sex the way we know it, and they're kissing. And it really turns out that the way the vampire gets off is by biting and feeding. It's also arousing to the human. But afterwards, the human character says, "So that's your action." And the vampire says, "Yeah, that's my action." And it's like this recognition that sexual arousal and sexual pleasure doesn't come from the genitals for him, but it's in fact a sexual act. And I think we have seen this sexual act between them and a consummation between them happen. So I don't miss anything. I think in retrospect, the kiss would have been very distracting, because I think it would have taken me out of the moment. It would have made me say, oh my God, they did it. They went there. They did the kiss. Like, it's not that I think, oh, we're just talking about a relationship that transcends sex. Sex can be part of a transcendent relationship. But that's not the one thing we're talking about here. And I think it would have just started my mind going in a direction that took me out of this moment, which is a perfect moment for me.
The Montaigne quote that you just read has an interesting little passage in there where he's like, let's skip the foreplay and get right to the action.
Yes.
A kiss is foreplay, and they have just consummated. Mm-hmm. Will laying his head on Hannibal's chest is so post-coital.
Yes.
And Hannibal's reaction to the hug is so completely ecstatic. Mm-hmm. This show also has established such a pattern of upending our expectations of cinematic choices. It makes you wonder if a kiss is an adequate tool to express what's going on between them anyway.
Right, yes, exactly, exactly. It's reductive.
They're the only two people in the world like that.
Yes.
And they're the only two people who can express their connection the way they just did. So isn't a kiss beside the point?
Yes.
Also, speaking of sex with Hannibal, sex is cheap to Hannibal. We've seen in the show. He's used as a tool of manipulation. Mm-hmm. And they just did this extraordinary thing. So I think a mere kiss would have felt like choreography from a different dance. Or like seeing a box of Oreos on Hannibal's kitchen counter, you know? Like, why take us there when we've been – why take us to such a familiar place when we've been in such a unique place?
Yes.
And then purely just the joy of analyzing this, I think it's nice that they didn't kiss, because we can have a good discussion about its absence, like in the way that, you know, the Venus de Milo statue – is interesting because it's missing its arms. Not if it had its arms, it would just be another statue of Aphrodite, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think purely in that way, it's just nice fuel for discussion. I realize there's a question of representation here too.
Oh, are you asking me, is this queer baiting? It's not.
Oh, I wasn't asking you if it was queer baiting. Oh,
okay.
I was asking you.
Because it's super queer.
They're about to kiss. I mean, they're so explicitly look like they're going to kiss, and then they don't, which says so much about the choice that Will is making here. He's the one, it seems, who makes the move to turn it into him laying his chest on Hannibal and then taking him over the edge. Mm-hmm. If they had kissed, what would have happened? They would have kissed. Maybe they would have broken the kiss. they would have continued to gaze at each other and then maybe the scene would have played out like it did. I feel like that could have invited an interpretation that Will was killing himself because he didn't want to face the fact that he was attracted to Hannibal. Mm-hmm. Or is it just
so right that could be a way people would go with it. You're really right. It would be a very regressive, a way that people could regressively interpret that. I mean, yeah. I suppose they could still regressively interpret it that way, but you're right. It would be more overt. What you recognize here is they have had the most fulfilling, ultimate physical and emotional joining that any two people could have and that only these two people could have. And
right.
And that's more than enough for us, you know? Like it's not like you're saying that means this isn't love, you know, the way people do about Wuthering Heights, right? Like it's the most sort of beautiful operatic ending to a love story.
You know, there's another thing here too that I like about there not being an explicit kiss, because this whole show is so connected to the history of horror and thriller cinema. And in that tradition, sex is subsumed and treated metaphorically by necessity. And I like that this connects to that tradition. I like that there's an aspect of Hannibal that can leave that explicit sexuality unexpressed because there is so much more going in here. And horror, much of horror vampires stems from this desire to discuss these desires
yes.
in polite company that you can't discuss in polite company in, you know, whatever, the European tradition or, you know, in the 18th century and whatever, 19th century. So the genre practically exists because you can't mm-hmm. explicitly show these
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. That's so wonderful. I mean, such a wonderful way of thinking about this.
So this brings me to something I wanted to say also, kind of a bit of an appreciation that's going to seem at this moment a little bit like a summary, but I think we're going to keep talking about this stuff. But I do have sort of a little bit of an appreciation that I wanted to express for horror and Hannibal and this community. It stems from a story I was telling you the other day about something that I talked about with my therapist.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I think anyone who's been in therapy will recognize that there are a few memories and stories that you come back to again and again because they feel emblematic. And if they're upsetting memories, they can feel freshly upsetting for decades, right? Mm-hmm. And part of the job of talk therapy is to continue to interpret these things and understand them better. And sometimes those things can be awful traumatic experiences, but in other cases, they can on their surface seem much milder. And the memory that I was talking to you about was when I was in fourth grade. So that was mean I was 9 or 10. I had a teacher who was really nasty to me. In a school system where teachers weren't expected to behave that way, right? Like you talk to your friends who went to Catholic school and they have endless stories of mean nuns. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, the nun did what? And they're like, yeah, that's nuns for you. You know, like, and you're like, okay, I guess that's what your teachers were like in school. But where we went to grade school, that wasn't the expected behavior. And this teacher used to call me out for having a messy desk or a messy notebook or for daydreaming. And she would make a big deal of these things and really lay into me in front of the class and be like, don't be like Matt. And there are a couple of these incidents that really stuck with me. And I revisit them to think about them from time to time. And I was talking about it with my therapist for like the 8,000th time. And I was saying to him, you know, as much as I have parsed this and understand it better, I'm still baffled because I don't know why a teacher would take so much pleasure in humiliating a kid like that. And he stopped me at the word humiliate because he said that word attributes a systematic, purposeful motivation to what she was doing. And in the best therapeutic way, I set about diluting the potency of this memory then by trying to understand it in context. The more I talked about it, the more I understood that even the best teachers have that one kid that just pushes their buttons for whatever reason. And that she lost control around me because she was expressing something that was less about me and more about her own emotional triggers or even something she was going through at the time. You actually confirmed this to me because you happened to know about her family. Yes. And that she had a problematic kid who I probably reminded her of. Mm-hmm. And that's useful in therapy because this takes a story like that from being something where I'm the protagonist and this teacher is the antagonist into something where I see her as a three-dimensional person for whom I was just a tiny fractional background character. And I think this is useful because therapeutically you turn down the volume on these bad memories, which makes it less likely to echo throughout your life. Right. And that's like the point of talk therapy. But in order to make the most of an insight like that, it does take empathy. In this case, defined as my ability to say, even if this person's behavior is baffling and offensive, it's more useful for me to understand how they arrived at that point than to simply be dismayed or feel persecuted or feel like I deserve to be treated that way, which is the way a little kid is going to feel. What she couldn't have known was that I and we grew up in a home where we were in trouble all the time, right? I won't elaborate too much on that. But we had a parent, her mother, who had very little empathy, which meant that she was in a constant state of dismay over, like, why aren't you behaving the way I want you to? So that's why this teacher's behavior was particularly upsetting to me, I think, because she was manifesting a lack of empathy. I was not a person to her. I was a symbol to her. And for her, that might have been momentary and not endemic. But she wasn't trying to humiliate me because in order to be mean to me in a purposeful way, she would have had to know exactly what would be most upsetting to me. And her absence of empathy made that impossible. Again, she wasn't seeing me as a person. She wasn't taking that level of consideration with me. And when I was sort of mulling this over, my therapist said to me, that's right. You interpreted her behavior as really mean. But to be that mean to someone requires empathy.
And your therapist is named Dr. Bedelia Demorier.
Extreme acts of cruelty require a high degree of empathy. My shrink literally said that to me. I feel like we need like a dramatic.
Yes, a crescendo.
Star Trek. So, Hannibal aside, so if you recognize this as true, you can really review a lot of those moments in your life when you might have felt oppressed or targeted and examine them from a different angle. And it doesn't mean that the goal of that is to like approve of the behavior that was directed at you or even forgive it, but the verdict of that behavior becomes very different. And so this has been a very useful thing for me to think about. And I don't know if this kind of amazing and weird moment that, and this was recent, a therapeutic moment, which the longer you kind of like are in therapy, the farther between these moments become, right? When you first start, you're like, ooh, this, ooh, that. Like, then after a while, you're like, why am I still doing this? But then like this will happen and you'll be like, oh, yeah. And I didn't know whether these explorations of Hannibal helped draw this out in therapy without me knowing it or whether they were just playing off each other or whatever it is. But this is where I get into the appreciation. This Hannibal may be so appealing to me because this discussion of the relationship between empathy and cruelty is at the core of the show. When we first meet Will, he's trying to apply his empathy to fight cruelty, to catch killers. And he sees it as a zero-sum choice, like empathy and cruelty are at opposite ends of the spectrum, right? Where if the more you express of one, the less you can express of the other. And Will's journey is about breaking that model. Hannibal says to him, what if there's a mix, a third axis on that scale, or what if it's not a scale at all, mm-hmm. right? What if it's, to use a food metaphor, if you combine the ingredients of empathy and cruelty, you get something new and tasty that doesn't resemble either. And in Hannibal world, this can be incredibly satisfying. Like if you're one of the two people whose brain is constructed to handle that result. And it happens to be only those two. And actually, this is, I had mentioned to you the wine bottle that shatters, and I looked at the label to see if it was Lecter Estate wine. I can't really tell if it is. It's not the Lecter family crest on that mm-hmm. bottle. I looked at it closely, but it's a yin-yang symbol. If you look at it, it's a shield that has that lion that's on the Lecter family crest, or that monster that's on the Lecter family crest, in black on a white side of the shield, and on the white side of the shield, there's another image in black. I wasn't able to find like a close up shot of it, but I looked at it. There's a yin yang symbol on the wine. So it's the taste of that mixture in this case is something that only two people are capable of experiencing. And I think this show, which you could call a niche show, which is maybe not to everyone's taste, has such a committed following because it's the kind of thing that's just going to taste great to a certain type of person. So much so that I wouldn't fault anyone for not liking this show, but someone who does like it goes up a lot of
in your book.
Places in my book, as they say in Diner. In my book. You just went down two places in my
book.
Odell, who do you pick? Sinatra or Matt? Would you just let that die, please?
It's important to me.
It's annoying it's me, important okay? In my You've life. Been I respect asking that question to every Mo that walks in here. Okay,
well,
would you just forget
Well, maybe,
it?
Maybe I have something to gain from the answer. Did you ever think of that? Maybe I have something
what
to gain.
What does it matter?
Let the man speak. Let the man speak. Speak.
Presley.
Okay, there you go. There is the definitive answer. Sinatra or Mathis, it's Presley. Fine.
You're
okay,
sick.
There. You got your... You feel better? I
your
mean,
opinion.
Did you learn something there?
You've gone like two steps below in my book.
So what makes us like the show then? And I was thinking about this. We were talking a few episodes back about how it's not uncommon for horror aficionados and writers and directors to say they identified with the monsters growing up, right? And that's a statement that I have to apply absolutely zero effort to understand. Loving horror is as core to my identity as anything I can think of, right? It's probably a top three bullet point in any like profile I would create of myself. So, but horror movies to me, the really good ones are like dreams. You know, they have this dreamlike quality like Hannibal often does. And if you buy the psychological construction that every character in a dream is some form of you, horror is allowing you to identify with the victims and also identify with the killers. And I think this is really useful to people who have experienced the sense of feeling unsafe, you know, in their lives. And I started to think about the ways people can feel targeted or unsafe, right? It can come in from a lot of directions. You can be raised in an environment that's unpredictable. You can feel targeted because the dominant culture makes you feel attacked, maybe for your gender, or your appearance, or your beliefs, or your economic situation. It could be because of something that you've experienced that continues to echo through your life. I sort of realized the folly of trying to create a taxonomy of all the ways people can feel unsafe because it could go on forever. But you can't similarly list out all the reasons why someone would like horror or gothicism or violence on screen. Some people just may find it entertaining, right? Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. But I don't think that's me. I don't think it's you. And I don't think it's a lot of people in the Hannibal community. I think we find safety in horror and in the company of others who like it. And I think one of the reasons why the Hannibal fandom feels so safe in part is because I think it distills the appeal of horror so directly. It invites us to identify with the aggressor and the victim at the same time, right? And I think this is why the movie The Bride of Frankenstein is so perfect. Yeah. In that movie, the monster is doing objectively terrifying things, but we also see his humanity and how unfair it is for him to have been made the way he is. And so I think we like this show so much because the show invites us to endlessly contemplate that mixture of aggression and fear that makes horror so effective, and that if you're a certain kind of person is something that you want to express. And I think that the really good horror creators are expressing this need to express this idea that I can be both the aggressor and the subject of aggression. And the way that Hannibal and Will come together in expressing both sides of that together and becoming whole because they're able to combine them perfectly is what is so appealing about this and why it has the enduring appeal and why those of us who like the show feel so deeply attached to it. What do you think?
I just think that's really just a beautiful way of describing what is so compelling about this show and what speaks to people about the show, to me, in a very personal kind of way, and why people love horror, and why people love horror in a very particular way. And a shared way. Yeah, I think there's something that's expressed through horror and through the show is that's about a very, very, I mean, look, I'm going to just sort of get into a different thing. But for me, there's something in this show that's really about a very primal longing, right? The show starts off, the show's about being seen, right? Being seen in the sense of being loved and understood and accepted for everything you are, and we see and the fear of that never happening, right? And the way, I mean, I guess the way that this show hits me so emotionally is that we see two people who their whole lives have known for a fact that that's not going to happen for them. Mm-hmm. That they're going to be alone in that way. And it's not just a feeling, like a feeling of insecurity or a feeling of hopelessness. It's actually a known fact because they know who they are. They know what their psyches are. They know what their makeup is. And basically, like, they're unicorns. And then you have this moment of... They have this moment of meeting somebody who is that person for them. And it doesn't just defy, it's not just unexpected. It shakes a foundational belief. And it's cataclysmic, this sort of coming together. And it's sort of an indescribable, unearthly, otherworldly thing. And I think it just sort of speaks to this very primal desire to be known in that way, to be seen in that way, to be loved in that way. And I think there's an aspect of horror that has to do with that desire and the fear of not being able to attain it, of always being kind of othered and separate. And feeling, obviously, and feeling, I mean, it's in all horror and fantasy is about feeling othered. And yeah, it's a very beautiful thing that exists in horror and fantasy. And it's a very particularly focused subject of this series that reaches you on a very gut emotional level. And it's very, very moving. I mean, I was just sort of thinking about, you know, you can analyze and think and all of this. And then there's also just this thing that hits you in the heart, you know, like, yeah. like there, you know, I was thinking, it's like, you think of the marriage vows to death do us part, like mm-hmm. their marriage vows are the opposite. Right? Death is what keeps them together. Life is what would part them because it's such an impossibility. And so to have this ending that is perhaps an ending that results in death and have that be a beautiful thing that you are not, I mean, there may be part of you that wants to see where they go and what happens to them, but you are not, it's not like, oh no, they're dead. Like, it feels absolutely the inevitable place that this series has taken us to from the very, very beginning when we were talking about seeing and eyes and looking at people's eyes. And yeah, so it is the most pure romantic element that exists in horror. And it's very, it just hits you on a very psychologically basic level.
Yep. It's doing what horror always tries to do, which is solve the conflicted feelings about death, the fascination and the terror. The ending of this episode, this finale, as you were just saying, that made me think that this is a really pure expression of what horror is trying to do. It's trying to, instead of make those things feel conflicted, it's offering a solution to that conflict. Mm-hmm. The dueling nature of that fascination and terror, it's saying there's a third way. You don't have to be afraid of it. You don't have to feel like being fascinated with it is illicit.
Yes, which is what kind of Will's becoming is, in a way. I mean, this is why this happens at the end. Like, if you were to say to Will, when he's standing there on the edge of the cliff, was this worth it? Was it worth it for what Hannibal put you through, what you put Hannibal through, for all of the shootings and stabbings and near deaths and scars and the destruction of so many people around you, was it worth it? The answer would 100% be yes, to have had this moment, right? And
yes.
And it's a pure expression of both love and death, love and violence. And it's just so good.
It's so good.
And I think I just want to add something about Hannibal. Look, I think it's unquestionable to me that Hannibal acquiesces to this. Like, I understand he's very taken up emotionally in the moment. I'm sorry, I'm just getting off track of what we were talking about. It just...
No.
But Hannibal, we had said earlier, it's also Hannibal's becoming, because he has, for the first time, really left his fate in Will's hands. And I think he's continuing to leave his fate in Will's hands. Like, I know he's emotionally ecstatic and also physically depleted. But Hannibal's Hannibal, right? If he wanted to get out of this, he'd find a way to get out of it. So I think it's clear he's going with Will because he has changed enough. This is his becoming, in that he is giving this up to this other person. And I really love that.
Boy, you know, when you were talking before a little bit more about horror, and just moments ago, I was really thinking about the term that has become very anathema to the horror community recently, the elevated horror, right?
Yes.
Fucking bullshit.
Yes.
Horror is practically the oldest genre there is.
Yes, we've talked about this before. This is what the point of horror was.
Yeah.
This is why horror exists.
Books were invented and there were horror books the next day. Movies were invented, there were horror movies the next day. And as you were saying that before, as you were talking about it before, I was just thinking, fuck people for saying elevated horror or degrading it, because what else are you trying to figure out through art than these issues? Mm-hmm. What else should you be talking about? Mm-hmm. What's more profound than to talk about the things that good horror, because I think there's hacky horror, obviously. Mm-hmm. That's not trying. But even so, even the hackiest stuff is related to this. Like these are the biggest questions that people ask and that we grapple with. And fuck anyone for saying that it is not profound and important to grapple with these things through art. Because what is more elevated than contemplating these things? Mm-hmm. And Hannibal just does such a, it is hard to think of any art, work of art or artistic, any artistic expression that does a better job of getting to this than Hannibal, and especially at the end of this season.
Yeah.
Which, of course, brings up the next question.
Is it the best finale?
No, sorry. My question is, do we really want another season?
Ah, okay. So before we get there, can I just throw in one other thing? Because I want to talk about that. I just wanted to talk about this whole idea about how the series ends and the sort of perfection of it. And we'll talk about where it compares or doesn't compare to other shows. But I had sent you a fic. I don't know if you ever finished it or you put it aside until the series was over.
That's what I did, because it was I found that it was getting in the way a little. It was great, but it was also getting in the way of me isolating what happens to them after is not something I wanted to think about.
Yes.
While we were still watching.
Yes. I had sent it to you because you had said something about, I can't really imagine, like, what happens? Are they like going off and having a domestic life together? And
yeah,
this particular fic, which I'll just name it and we can link it. It's by an author. I don't know how you say the author's name, but it's, I think of it in my head as Emungere, but it's Emungere, which sort of has our name in it. And the fic I'm talking about is Two Solitudes. I really like this author's fic. I haven't read a great deal of Hannibal fic. I think partly because I don't really need Hannibal fic in the way that in other fandoms, kind of reading fic to fix things.
Address deficiencies.
Yes, I mean, those are known as fix-it fix. But
right.
Or to prolong, you know, whatever the case may be. But
yeah, you want more.
But... and I didn't feel like I really needed that, which I guess will lead us into our next discussion. And also, there's a thing that happens sometimes when I'm reading fic in a fandom. I have fandoms where I've read much more fic than this, and than I have in Hannibal. And sometimes you come across a story or an author that has really said exactly what it is you're thinking or feeling about the show or the characters or their fates. And then I'm like, well, why am I going to read anything else? It's not going to be, and it's also really well written. So
yeah,
this fic is beautifully written and it really expresses a lot of things. And I think creates a very plausible scenario of what could happen post season. So this, I guess, will take us into this discussion about post series finale or post season three finale. And if you don't want to hear, this is not really a spoiler, but if you don't want to hear this, you know, just skip ahead for a minute. In the fic, Will and Hannibal survive the fall. They are very severely injured, particularly Hannibal. They are on the run. Hannibal almost dies. And they reach a point where they are they're at the end of the line. They're out of resources. They are both physically in poor shape. They're in like a snowstorm. They don't have money. They don't have IDs. They don't, you know, fake IDs. They don't have a car even. They don't have a vehicle. And they're just sort of wandering off, evading the FBI. And Hannibal says something about essentially, what are we doing? This is going nowhere, essentially. And and Will, in the fic, Will says, what's the worst that could happen? And Hannibal responds, we will die together. And Will says, right. So what are you worried about? Mm-hmm. And I think it's just a really beautiful way of encapsulating the end of this show. And also sort of saying, if this is where the show ends, what are you worried about? I mean, right. there's you don't have to go anywhere else. How I would feel about a fourth season is it's difficult. I feel there is I am utterly satisfied with the way this series ended. If anything, I would want more of what comes before this. Do you know what I mean? I would like to, if this had been 5 seasons or 6 seasons leading up to this point, I'm sure there could have been a lot of other murders and a lot of other things. And I would sort of prefer that because the ending really gives me so much of what I want, if not everything that I want, in an ending. Having said that, I would still love to see these characters again, and I have a lot of faith that Brian Fuller wouldn't do anything substandard and that he wouldn't do it if it wasn't going to be meaningful and excellent. So I guess I feel torn is how I feel. I have very mixed feelings about it, and I don't sit here and think, oh my God, I wish there was another season, I wish there was another season, I wish there was another season. It's not like I'm in this constant state of like missing something. Would I be excited if there was an announcement that there was going to be a fourth season? Of course I would. So yes. My feelings are very mixed about it. You?
I feel that way too. I completely understand that obviously the fandom, much of the fandom really wants a fourth season and demonstrates that. And I too would be extraordinarily happy if a fourth season was, I'd be on board instantly and I'd probably just love it. And I agree with you that Brian Fuller is not going to take these characters that he has nurtured so responsibly and do something irresponsible with it. And
the thing is, he has said he had another season planned. So yes. It's hard to imagine that he had a season planned that wasn't going to be good, right? I mean, you can have
because he was planning it while making this. I mean, yeah.
You can have a debate, about is season 3 as good as, what's the best season? Is season 3 as good as season 2?
Oh, I wouldn't debate that at all.
I think people do, but it's hard to imagine that while he was in the throes of this creative process, he was like, oh yeah, let me throw in a fourth season.
And I, until we did this rewatch, and I started thinking more about this vibration that Will is involved with, I really didn't imagine that a fourth season could reach the heights that this season does, because I don't understand what more needs to be said. However, in examining it more closely, you do see that Will is continuing to go back and forth right up until literally the last instant. You could imagine a world where they fall into the water and then he's like decides whether he's going to let Hannibal drown or not, right? Mm-hmm. Like it could just keep going on. You could see it keep going on, and that being the issue that's being dealt with in a way more explicit way, because now they're together.
Mm-hmm.
And I could really see that real proximity creating new layers to this discussion. And I also think that you could see now that time has really now elapsed since this show ended. The actors are older. Everyone's older. nobody's going to be coming to this with the same perspective that they had when they first worked on it. And I sort of like the idea that with all this elapsed time now built in, you have to say, okay, these two have had this relationship. This just happened. It can't have just been happily ever after that moment, right?
No.
Right? So you could really see a lot of fascinating interplay between the two of them. And now that so much time has really elapsed, and you're not going to be able to put these actors back into the show and have it even seem at all like it's happening the moment after they went over the cliff.
Yes.
You are going to have to account for the time that has elapsed since the last time we saw them. And so your comment about like you'd like to see more of what happened before, well, I think you could imagine like the show now saying, let's now build in 10 years of history of their relationship and meet them at this moment when all of that has happened.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Who knows what's going to, maybe they have more scars. Will could be missing an arm. Like you just don't know, right? What might have happened between them in the intervening time. And you could imagine a lot of stuff playing out now. You could even imagine the show taking a completely different tone. In the way that the last seasons of The Sopranos take a completely different tone from the earlier seasons. So I am sort of fascinated as to what kind of project it could be. If Brian Fuller woke up tomorrow and went on Twitter and said, everyone, I'm really sorry. This is never going to happen. I'm going to stop trying. I'm going to stop pitching it. Let's just package it up.
Enjoy what we have.
And enjoy what we have. I'd have no problem with that either. And I would just rewatch the show over and over and over again and continue to think about it.
Yes.
I guess that's where I stand on it.
Yep. Okay. We're in agreement. Do we want to talk about well, first of all, let me ask you this before we get to whether it's the best series finale. Do you think it's the best season finale of this series? Do you like this episode, or can you compare this episode in your mind with Mizumono? I mean, I think that the last episode of season one is also phenomenal, but Mizumono is incredibly beautiful and rich, and it just gave me something that just stunned me, really. I'm much happier to have the series end up where it does, though. And it's brilliant.
We said this when we talked about Mizumono. This would have been a perfectly fine series finale, right?
Yes, but I wouldn't have been as happy. I would not have felt content about where the two of them ended up. Whereas oddly, with both of them going over the cliff, I do.
I agree. So I guess then I would shade towards saying that the season three finale is more satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the artfulness of Mizumono, because it is set up from the beginning of the season. That entire season is told in flashback working up to the finale.
And yet it's still shocking.
And yet it's still shocking, and yet it still reveals more. And the shocking behavior that you see, the ruthlessness of Hannibal.
Mm-hmm. Not just towards Jack, which is what you see in the beginning.
But toward, just his willingness to burn the house down.
Because his heart's broken.
Because his heart's broken is incredibly powerful. But what are you going to do? You're not going to argue against the artfulness of Wrath of the Lamb.
No.
And you're not going to argue against those final moments when love crime kicks in.
No, it's unbelievable.
And you're not going to argue against the post-credits view of Bedelia.
Oh, can we talk about the post-credit sequence for 1 second before before we go into whether it's the best series. I just wanted to say, you know, obviously, you know, this is, you know, the illusion is that Hannibal and probably Hannibal will have come back, and Hannibal is eating Bedelia. As Bedelia has expressed, she knows he wants to, and Will has said meat's on the menu. But it really took me back to a prior episode, I think Number of the Beast is 666, when Bedelia says to Will, he took your family away from you, and Will says, what's he going to take from you? Which it's answered quite specifically right here, her leg. And her question is it important that he take something from me? The answer to that is yes. And it's important he take this from you, and which really just makes me think, yes, definitively, aside from the two play settings, that Will is there because this is something Will wants her to get, something taken from her in all the way only Hannibal can do it. And I just thought I just liked it.
Yeah, I like it too. And it's this idea that, okay, in this multiverse, we survived this fall.
Yes.
Let's eat Bedelia's leg, I guess.
This is the thing about it, which right. Also, I guess, is comments on what would have happened or what could happen in a season four, or how you'd feel about it. This could have ended very easily without the stinger, and I still would have felt this was perfect. And I don't think the stinger... I don't think necessarily the stinger makes it better. I like it, but it certainly doesn't make it worse for me either. Like, it's not like I'm like, oh, they should have just ended it there. I didn't need this. It's, so it suggests to me you can have more after this ending that you would like, right? This is after the ending, what we see with Bedelia. And,
right.
And for me, I like it. It doesn't detract from the ending. It doesn't taint the ending. So that would sort of lead me to believe that I wouldn't be disappointed with further adventures.
What would you like more than watching Bedelia, while being eaten by Will and Hannibal, spar with them verbally about it?
Oh, also I really didn't notice before. I'm sorry to just get into a mundane detail, but the fork she picks is like an oyster fork. It's just harkens back to I don't eat anything with a what does she say? A skeletal
without a central nervous system,
right? He's feeding her oysters again, oysters because they make her tastier.
Yeah,
I mean, she has an oyster fork, and it also reckon back to Hannibal at Verger's table when they let him hold a fork and he doesn't use it because it's not going to get him anywhere, and it's not going to get Bedelia anywhere either, but she's still fighting.
And that's the great thing about it, is you really wouldn't mind seeing Bedelia continue to fight them,
or try and talk her way out of it, or snipe her way with more bitchy comments with Will that Hannibal would be. Hannibal really has never seen Will and Bedelia having a bitch fight with each other. Can you imagine how ecstatic he would be? That would be like the good porn for him.
And what's she going to do in the middle? She's going to stick that fork in one of their eyes, you know? Like, you know, maybe the next season one of them has an eye patch because Bedelia, like, plucked their eye out. I mean, you would love to see this. Yes, and I guess it does say that there is more to explore and more to think about as the two of them are collaborating as cannibals. I don't know. We'll find out. I guess we'll find out, or we won't find out. And in the multiverse, the show gets picked up. And in the other multiverse,
it doesn't.
It doesn't. And
Or it's just a dead and alive cat.
Yeah.
Okay, everyone, we covered a lot of ground in that hour, so we'll break there, and next time we'll talk about how The Wrath of the Lamb compares to our other favorite finales. All right, see you then.